Well, today, of course, is President's Day. I hope you have the day off. And indeed, that's what President's Day is to a lot of people, right? A day to not work. But it's also, hey, a day to remember and honor our leaders, even if that term president, the actual word, was once meant to be anything but honorable. In fact, before 1787, when the Constitution was ratified, the term president had never before referred to a head of state. So how did George Washington and other founders settle on president as opposed to, say, chief magistrate, emperor, prime minister, potentate? Well, joining us is Mark Forsyth, author of the Etymologicon and Horologicon, who blogs at inkyfool.com. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Good to have you. This term president these days sounds like somebody who's powerful and flies on Air Force One and gets all the respect, but it wasn't always so.
No, the whole idea of president is it's meant to sound really humble. It's meant to be an absolutely nothing title. Because when the United States was just setting itself up and trying to work out its constitution, its titles, there was the question of what to call George Washington. And one of the big things that people worried about was that George Washington might become a dictator himself. You'd just thrown off George III, and now there was this guy with all this power, General Washington. And so they needed to bring him back down to earth, or that was the feeling in the House of Representatives. So they didn't want to give him a grand title. And there were a lot of possibilities for what they might call him. They might call him emperor or king was even on the table, His Highness George Washington. But they wanted to make sure he didn't get drunk on power, he didn't get carried away. And so they gave him the most pathetic title they could think of. And that title was president, which at the time meant almost nothing. It was little more than being like foreman or overseer or manager of the country. Indeed, president was the standard term for somebody who ran a company in North America at the time.
Or who runs a meeting. I mean, president is just the person who says, okay, everybody sit down and let's start the meeting. I mean, really boring.
Yeah, it's just what it is, just the guy who presides over a meeting. Yeah, that's all president was. And in fact, there was an awful lot of argument about it at the time because, as I say, the House of Representatives, they really wanted to keep George Washington down and not give him any sort of grandiose title like King or Emperor or Your Highness. But the Senate really wanted to give him a good title because they said this guy has to go negotiate with other nations. He has to be impressive, and America will be a laughingstock if our head of state has a pathetic little title like President of the United States of America. So the Senate really wanted to have King or Highness or something along those lines, just so he could meet foreign dictators, foreign kings, monarchs on an equal basis.
And of course, over the years and generations since then, it's sort of easy to see how the term president has changed in our minds because of the power of the office. And I wonder if the term president and our perception of the word has sort of ebbed and flowed with the power of the presidency. Look, the presidency is not today what it was when George Washington was president. We've always had fights about how powerful the president really is. Has the word gotten more and less powerful at the same time?
The word has gotten so much more powerful, it's unbelievable, because the thing is, politicians are always trying to change reality by using particular words, using language, you know, do you call them freedom fighters or terrorists or that sort of thing? But the President of the United States is and has been for at least 50 years the most powerful man in the world. I mean, he has over 5,000 nuclear warheads at his disposal, a fleet of drones, the largest economy in the world, and all that sort of stuff. So, of course, President of the United States, which was picked as this title to keep him down, is now the most impressive sounding title on earth. But now I think it's about 150 countries have presidents, because everyone who's a head of state now wants to sound like they're as powerful as the President of the United States of America.
It's a good brand now.
Yeah, it's a great brand.
Mark Forsyth is author of the Etymologicon and Horologicon. He blogs at inkyfool.com with a history of the word we take for granted, president. Mark, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You know, Jimmy Carter has become known since the 70s for a couple of things. You probably know what they are. How about long gas lines, the Iran hostage crisis, maybe that M word, malaise? But did you know that Jimmy Carter's encounter with an angry swamp rabbit in the spring of 1979 lasted only a second, but it played a key role in derailing his hopes for a second term? It's true. It changed the way American presidents have managed their image since then. Now, if you don't believe me, let's go back to 1976. The story begins there, when Jimmy Carter is an unknown on the national stage. But he has a compelling resume.
He's a peanut farmer, a Baptist deacon, an 11-year Navy veteran, and a nuclear engineer.
Carter beats Gerald Ford in 1976, but he gets to the White House and finds a country in turmoil.
Some 60 Americans, including our fellow citizen whom you just saw bound and blindfolded, are now beginning their sixth day of captivity inside the U.S. Embassy in Tehran.
WNYC reporter Jim O'Grady says that all that turmoil set the stage for a silly story that blew up into what we'd now call a meme and did serious damage to Carter's presidency and his legacy. Jim O'Grady joins me now. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Todd.
I mentioned at the top of this a killer rabbit attack. Can you please explain what I'm talking about?
So it's the spring of 1979. As you say, there's all this turmoil going on in the country, in the White House. So President Carter goes back to his hometown in Plains, Georgia for a vacation. And he gets in a little fishing boat and he goes out on a pond and he hears something from behind, some disturbing noise. He turns around and I'll let AP reporter Brooks Jackson describe what happens next.
It was hissing, tried to get in the boat, and he had to fend it off with an oar. He had been approached by a swimming rabbit, a big one, he said, a killer rabbit.
A rabbit coming at the boat?
Well, it's down in Georgia, they call them swamp rabbits, and they swim and they get agitated. So it was approaching the boat. And Brooks Jackson said, okay, it's August when he hears about it. He writes the story because it's a slow news day. He knows he's learned that he can write a long piece about the Social Security system, but the piece that people will read and talk about is a story about animals. So he writes it up, and the thing, it just goes viral. There are these editorials written about it, cartoons in the paper, and check this out. There's novelty songs, including this one.
President Carter got into his boat, wasn't in a hurry, wanted to float. Think about the country, think about sin. Along swam a rabbit and he tried to climb in. And what did Jimmy say? I don't want a bunny wunny in my widow old boat. In my widow old boat in the pond. For the bunny,
it blows up. And I asked Kevin Mattson, he's the historian we heard earlier, why this story went so big.
I think in many ways the story of the killer rabbit incident only makes sense when you understand what else was going on during the summer of 1979.
All right. What was going on in the summer of 1979, he says. What's he referring to?
So all those crises we described before. And also you have to remember that Jimmy Carter ran for president with a slogan. After Vietnam and after Watergate, his slogan was, I will never lie to you. And you can hear it in this campaign commercial.
I'll never tell a lie. I'll never make a misleading statement.
So don't tell me that Jimmy Carter took that so seriously that he put this killer rabbit story out himself.
That's exactly what happened.
He Oops.
Because when the story first came out, people didn't believe it. They said, really? No, that doesn't make sense. Rabbits don't swim. And this wounds Carter because his reputation for honesty is all important to him. So he makes the White House photographer go back to the darkroom, fish out a photo of the rabbit swimming away after Carter has splashed it with his paddle, blow it up, and release it to the press. And that's when the story just takes off.
This is a good time to tell people that you can look at the killer rabbit photo that Jim O'Grady refers to on thetakeaway.org. So the songs get written, the papers go with it, it gets out there. Does this contribute to the, like, a wimp image that we have today? I mean, you know, like a greater man, a Ronald Reagan, wouldn't get attacked by a little tiny cute rabbit? Is that
That's exactly the idea?
It's,
you know, it's not fair, but it's politics, which is driven very often by symbolism. It crystallizes this idea that he's not exactly in control of events. This guy who's supposed to protect us from nuclear attack by the Soviet Union lets a rabbit get the drop on him when he's out fishing. So what Carter does is he hires an advertising man from Wall Street called Gerald Rafshoon to head up something called the White House Image Repair Team. We take this for granted today, this kind of like image operation.
Ongoing today. There's no repair team. It's ongoing now.
It's institutionalized.
Yeah.
But back then, this was a very unusual thing, and Carter was criticized that, like, why can't you just speak to the people? Why do you need a Svengali managing your image? And it's at this moment that the Reagan campaign team looks at the killer rabbit story and they think two things. A, Carter is beatable, and B, when we get in the White House, we are never going to let that happen to us. And it's the Reagan White House that installs this machinery that we have to this day with photo ops and image management. I think Obama has something like three people to manage his Twitter feed. This is the modern press office of the American presidency. It comes out of fear of the killer rabbit.
Jim O'Grady is here to say that you can attribute the modern managed image of the president of the United States, not to television, not to the internet, but to one angry killer swamp rabbit.
That's right, Todd. We tried to get an interview with the rabbit, but he was unavailable.
Jim O'Grady, thank you.
You're welcome.
If you want to hear Jim O'Grady's complete reporting on this story, head over to WNYC.org. You can also find his full interview with I Don't Want a Bunny Wunny songwriter Tom Paxton, and to see those photos of the attack, just go to the website, thetakeaway.org.
President Carter saved the day, splashed with a paddle, rabbit swam away. Jimmy was a hero, felt it in his bones, said in the words of John Paul Jones.
Now imagine if the 24-hour news cycle had been around in 1979 when that swamp bunny attacked Jimmy Carter. It would have been a way different story. Well, coming up, we're talking with Alain de Botton about the pros and cons of that never-ending news cycle. What do you think? Does the 24-hour news cycle turn you off?
Hi, this is Michael from Seattle. I don't think it's the 24-hour news cycle that's the problem, although they do create news where none is. I think it's the people that watch the 24-hour news. We should know better than to sit around watching the news all day and getting worked up about nothing.
Michael says, just turn it off. What do you think? Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. There's much more at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.